Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to SMCC Audio Messages. We are excited to be serving you wherever you are and to be continuing to reach as many people as possible and help them take their next step in full devotion and full delight in Jesus Christ. We'd love to help you personally take your next step. You can check out all the next steps that we have available at smccutah.org/next steps. If you'd like to support the incredible mission of SMCC, one of the ways you can do that is by financially partnering with us. You can find more information about this at smccutah.org/give. If you'd like to dive deeper into what SMCC is all about, you can also subscribe to the Fully Delighted podcast. Now, on to the message for today.
All right, well, go ahead and bring it in. Let's bring it back together. For those of you I haven't met, my name's Trevor, and man, good bit of emotions this morning, right? We've got baptisms we're celebrating, so kind of a high note, a peak emotionally, and then also some staff transitions, some people moving on who've been here for a long time and served in really significant ways. So kind of a mixture of emotions this morning that I think is worth acknowledging. And in light of that, what I want to say, I want to talk from the subject of careless trust. This morning of careless trust. And so in light of that, if it's your first time here, if you're brand new, never been here before, I just want to say thank you for trusting us enough to kind of cross the threshold, make your way on in here, and just spend a chunk of your morning with us. I know that depending on where you're at, it might seem like a small thing to come check out a new church. Maybe it is not a small thing at all. Maybe it's a significant thing, a scary thing, and not an easy next step to take. So I just want to acknowledge that and say thank you for trusting us with a little bit of your time this morning. And at the same time, if you're not new, if you have been here for a long time, for a good stretch of time, then that means you've been here through highs and lows, much like what we have this morning, where there are moments of celebration and moments of heaviness that are happening within any community. And so thank you for trusting us to be really the community of faith that you call home. That's not something that we take lightly. And so just want to thank you for that this morning. Now, with that, I want to tell you a little bit of a story of a concert that I went to back in the day, back in my early 20s. And the concert, the story goes like this. Back in that season of my life, music was something that I really enjoyed a lot leading up to it, but I didn't have the chance to go to many concerts of the bands that I liked because many of the band members were no longer alive. And so I just had this stretch where I liked a lot of older bands. And then coming out of that, I found some new bands that I really liked that were still alive, still playing, still touring. And so I had the chance to go see one of them in concert. That is still to this day a band that I really cherish. So the band was Switchfoot. The concert was back when I was living in the Midwest, so it was in the Majestic Theater, downtown Madison, Wisconsin, this old school kind of theater, this cinema that had been transformed into a concert venue. And it was so much fun that when the main band came out, the band leader, the band singer at a certain point, he kind of introduces the rest of the band members as his best friends in the world. They're interacting with each other, having so much fun, and they created such a good experience for everyone who was there, so much so that it became really clear that they weren't there really to get anything from us other than the money that we paid for the tickets, but really it was a way that they served, a way that they created an experience that added value to other people's lives, and that made it such an enjoyable thing. And I cannot stress how much of a contrast that was with the band that warmed us up, the warm-up band. Because when I found out who was playing for the warm-up band, I was actually pretty excited because I knew the band, and I was more than a fan on the basis of this, that their hit song actually had some real estate on my MySpace page for a season. So I was, you know, I was into them. And then coming into the concert, you know, they come on out, and in every song, the lead singer is playing, and he's singing, and he's doing his thing. Never once does he even look at another band member, never interacts with them, never introduces them. You don't learn anyone else's name, but in between every song, he goes on these extended monologues that are entirely about himself. It got to be so awkward that when I walked away from the concert, there was only one of those bands that I still wanted to have anything to do with my MySpace. MySpace was done at that point, it was over, but there was only one that I wanted to listen to more. And I think what was underneath that is the idea that a person's why matters. that a person's motivation matters. And one of the things that felt so clear with the opening band is that it felt like he was there not to serve us or to create an experience for everyone who was there, but he was there essentially to prop himself up with us, that as he got our attention, as he got our praise, that was something that made him feel better about himself, and that was the part that we played in the equation, and something about it just felt so cringy in a sense. And I think that in some ways demonstrates something that is so important to the idea of trust. Because today, we're continuing our series called Trust Issues, where we are breaking down really the components of trust. And one of the things we talked about last week is that there are five parts to trust. We open up with the first one, which is understanding, and then after that, there are four more. And today, intent or motivation is the second one that we're looking at. And the reason this matters is because trust matters. I think one of the things every one of us can know and recognize is that trust is so central to all of life in relationships, because if we can't trust, then that means we don't have the ability to actually be at ease within our relationships with God, with others, or even within a church. That if we have the inability to trust, that means we don't have the ability to be at peace, to be at ease, to be relaxed, to, in a sense, to be careless within our relationships. And what that inability pushes us into is a way of life that is stressed, that is tense, that is incredibly anxious, because we have the inability to be at peace, which is what comes with trusting. And yet at the same time, if we have that inability, it's likely because we place trust in someone or something at some point and everything went horribly wrong. And so the goal for this series is that in breaking down trust and understanding and working it through these categories of God, others, and church, we can have an understanding of when it's worth placing trust in others and when it is not. And so I want to continue that conversation today, but at the same time, I got to let you know that we actually have more than one objective together this morning, that there's two things that I'd like us to do together. And so the second one is to continue the conversation around trust and to move into intent and motivation and to talk about how that plays out within our lives and our relationships. But before that, we actually have another task, another objective that I'd like us to kind of break down together. And it has to do with this tension. That's almost like a prequel to our series altogether. That maybe you're feeling this, maybe you're not, but the question would be, if trust is so central to life and relationships, then why don't I see it more within the biblical writings? If it's such a predominant theme, if it's so central, if it is the ability to even breathe and be at ease within relationships, if it's that dominant of a theme, then why doesn't the Bible talk about it more? Why is it not a central theme there? And what I'd like to do is really let our first objective, our first task, be to answer that question so that when we get to the second half, we can all come to the table together to see how intent plays such a central role within trust. So if we could this morning on the first task, I'd like to ask your permission. What I'd like to do is just go to the classroom together for a little bit. If I could, I want to get my whiteboard, and just because it's fun for me. And also, I think it'll be helpful for the conversation. So we'll get to this in just a minute. What I want to do is something called a word study. And here's why. So question is, why don't we see trust more within the Bible if it's such a dominant theme within our lives? So I want to show you one place we do see trust within the Bible. So this is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. It reads like this. It says, "Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see." Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, why did you quote that verse? Why did you read that one? Trust isn't even in there, right? Well, it is actually. We just have to dig a little bit deeper. So what I want to do this morning is something called a word study, a three-step process that we can use to understand a biblical passage, really to understand anything, but it's especially important when it comes to understanding the Bible. So we're in the classroom for this. We've got our whiteboard. A word study is what we're going to do. And the first step in a word study is identifying the word that you're going to study. And so you want to pick a word that really carries weight, right? You want to pick a word that is significant, that's important, perhaps it's repeated. You want to pick a word that when it comes to the meaning of the sentence or the paragraph or the passage, the word that carries the most weight. And the question is, if we go back to this verse, Hebrews 11 chapter 1, which word carries the most weight? Feel free to help me out on this. Which one would you say? Faith. Yeah, I know. We bolded it. It makes it a little easier. So the truth is, there's other words too that would be worth looking into, like confidence and hope and assurance. All of those are valuable and valid words to look into. But today, we're gonna look at faith. So that's our word for today that we're gonna study. So three-step process, we've already checked the first one off together. So faith is our word. Now the second step is this, to discover the original word's range of meaning. Discover the original word's range of meaning. And the language here is intentional. So the biblical writings actually weren't originally created within English, but they were written in other languages, primarily in Greek and in Hebrew, and then some portions in Aramaic. So when it comes to this passage, the New Testament was primarily written, or was written in the Greek language in the first century. So what we find is that if we're gonna study this word faith, we have to actually understand the word that was translated into it. Because the original author who wrote the letter Hebrews, he didn't write faith, he wrote another word that was brought into this. And so what's important to do is to gain an understanding of that particular word. But before we do that, I think what I want to do is first kind of demonstrate the process of what this often looks like in our lives and why doing the process in another way is actually so worthwhile. So, to discover the original word's range of meaning. That's the second step. But I think oftentimes we end up inserting another second step, an alternative second step, into our process when we're reading our Bibles. And I think it can look like this, that instead of going back to that original word, a lot of times we just hang out with the English. And so let's just say, hypothetically speaking, you know, you're reading on your phone or whatever, or your Bible, you're reading through Hebrews 11:1, and you get to that passage, and you're like, I wonder what faith means here. Seems like a word that carries a lot of meaning, a lot of weight. If I dive down into this word, I think it'll help my understanding of this passage. And so so you say to yourself, well, what are all of the meanings that faith has? And so let me just throw this up on the screen. These are different meanings of the word faith. Now, I want to be clear here that these are not biblical definitions of the word faith. And so if there is a point in today where you're gonna snap a pic and throw it up on Instagram, this is not the slide to do that with. I wanna make that clear. But these are a compilation of what I've found using an actual dictionary and then just what I have found from my experience with 21st century Utahn English, which is its own category. And so with that, what I would say is these are different ways that I have found, have heard people using the word faith, that we use the word faith. And so with that, first one, a feeling that fosters belief in something. If I think about this, and if I have a feeling that occurs while I'm thinking about this, considering its validity, considering its truth or certainty, then that feeling, which is faith, lets me know that this is true. So that's one way of understanding the word faith. Again, not a biblical way, but it is a way that the word is used in English. Another one would be a force that enables one to access God's power. That the more faith I have, the more I'm able to access God's power for my life, for my relationships, for my job opportunities, for my bank account, right? And the less faith I have, the less I'm able to access God's power for these areas of my life. Again, not a biblical understanding of the word, but it is a way that the word is used. The third one is that it's firm belief in something for which there is no proof. That to have faith in something is to say, I believe this even without evidence, even when the evidence is against it. Once again, not a biblical understanding of the concept of the word, but it is a way that the word is used. And then fourth and fifth, fourth being allegiance to duty or to a person. That actually is a pretty biblical way of understanding the word. And then fifth, belief and trust in and loyalty to God. Trust and loyalty being sort of central to that understanding. So here's, I think, a lot of times what can happen when we're reading the Bible and we come across a word that we're not quite sure what it means. We think through all of these different meanings that we've heard, that we're familiar with, and then we just kind of pick whichever one seems to feel best, whichever one seems to fit best to us, and we insert that into the passage, and then that guides our understanding of what this is saying. And here's the trouble with that. That essentially, when we do that, what we have done is we've discovered the range of meaning, not of the original word, but of the word that has been used to translate the original word into English. And so we've taken one of these meanings and applied it. And the trouble with that is we're discovering the range of meaning of the wrong word. So the word in Greek that actually is translated into faith is the Greek word pistis. And I swear to you, I did not just swear on stage. It's an actual word. So, but there's an overlap between them. So there's a point at which they do share meaning. And that is what makes translation possible. That's why this word can be used to translate that word. But they also each carry meanings that the other could never possibly have. That faith has meanings that pistis could never actually mean. And the trouble is, when we take one of these, like faith is firm belief in something without proof, without evidence, or we say that it's basically what enables me to access God's power, or it's a feeling that gives me a sense of certainty about something. When we take that and insert that into the passage, we're inserting a meaning into it that the original word never could have possibly meant. And in doing so, we end up butchering the passage, murdering its meaning, and walking away with a completely different understanding that never would have even been possible in the original language. And so, it's worth looking into how to get the second step right. And I think one way to kind of, you know, illustrate what this looks like is that imagine this scenario. Imagine there is sort of a teenager who just turned 16 and gets a car for their birthday. Not a new car, but let's say an old beater, and they get the keys to it, and it's all very exciting. And the kid has been responsible up until this point in their lives, and so the parent says to them, or the parents say, that, you know, you have done a good job and you've been responsible, so we're going to entrust you the keys to this car. And the kid says, hey, can I go out with my friends? I want to go hang out. And they say, yeah, that's fine, but we're going to give you a curfew, so you got to be back at this time. And confession, you know, I don't have kids old enough to know what curfew time makes sense, and I'm not young enough to remember what my curfews were, but so we'll say 11:30 p.m. 11:30 is the time they set. You gotta be home at 11:30 p.m. And so the kid goes out and they're hanging out waiting for the kid to come back, and you know, it's 10 o'clock, it's 10:30, all fine, nobody's worried. It's 11, starting to wonder, are they gonna get home? It's 11:15, it's 11:24, 11:27, where are they? 11:29, it's 11:30, 11:35, man, they're late. It's 12, it's 12:30, it's 1:15. At 2:30 in the morning, finally, the front door creaks open quietly and they walk in. And the parents stand up off the couch and they're like, where on earth have you been? We said your curfew was 11:30. Why are you getting home 3 hours later? And the kid begins to explain himself, saying, well, yeah, okay, I know. Let me just explain. I know that you said my curfew is 11:30 p.m., and I know that one of the meanings of curfew is that it means be home before this time. But I was talking with my friends, and they felt like curfew also means be home after this time. Don't be home before this time. And so I was thinking about what you said, and I was trying to figure out what felt right, and it just seemed to me like curfew means don't be home before this time. So I was just trying to do what you said, and My question is there any household in this country, in the world, in which that explanation would fly? And I do not believe the answer is yes. And yet so often, unintentionally, we can end up doing the very same thing with the biblical writings when we take a word and we assign a meaning to it that never could have possibly been there, that it could have never possibly meant. And so, again, step two is all about really discovering the original word's range of meaning. Not the English word's range, but the original word's range of meaning. And so there's a variety of ways to do this. I would say that if you're in a small group here, small groups actually have the chance to kind of work through this process over the next week to see what that looks like. We also have our SMCCU classes. Quick plug, Making Sense of the Bible is our class that is all about how do you study the Bible. And they walk through word studies in that. So those will be kicking up in the fall. Which is an early plug that I'm giving you for that. But they walk through this process. But beyond that, there's resources like Blue Letter Bible, for example, is one that I utilize for this. So if you look at Blue Letter Bible, it's a website, and these are the two meanings that they offer for the Greek word pistis, that it's conviction of the truth of anything, belief. Beyond that, they go on to say that in the New Testament, conviction or belief respecting man's relationship to God and divine things, generally with the included idea of trust and holy fervor born of faith and joined with it. I get that some of that language is a bit archaic, but central to that definition, to that understanding, is the idea of trust. And then beyond that, you see the second meaning, which is fidelity or faithfulness. It's describing someone as being reliable, someone who is trustworthy. So those are the two things that the Greek word pistis can mean in the New Testament, that it does mean. That's the summary of what it means within the New Testament writings. And so that's step two, discover the original word's range of meaning. Now step three is to determine what the word's meaning is in this context. And that's an important point in this context, that it's not our creativity that determines meaning. It's not what it feels like it means to us that determines it. It's not what we think will make us sound more spiritual and intelligent to our friends that determines what it means, right? It's the context that someone who actually was a real person wrote this to a particular person or a group of people, and they meant something specific when they did, even when they chose this specific word. And the best clues that we have for understanding what that word means is everything else that they put around it, the context. And so if we kind of zoom out on Hebrews 11:1, take a couple of verses that come after it, what we see is this, that now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. The verse is actually giving a definition of faith or of pistis. This is what the ancients were commended for. The rest of the chapter goes on to really honor different people throughout the Old Testament whose stories are recorded there for the ways that faith was central to how they lived their lives. And then we see in verse 3, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Basically, we look at the world around us, we see that there is a design, which indicates that there was a designer. And so this leads us to trust the understanding that there is a God who created all things. And so what we see is that faith is carrying the majority of the weight here in terms of meaning, not just for verse 1, but for verses 1 through 3, and even for the entire chapter, that it is the central theme of Hebrews chapter 11. And I think when we break it down and we look at the different meanings we had for pistis, one of the things that becomes clear is that it's not describing someone as being reliable or trustworthy. It's describing faith really as trust. That you could even substitute the word trust in for faith there, that trust is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By trust, we understand these things. So I think you could break it down like this, that in this passage, the conclusion of our word study is that faith equals trust. To put it into our own messy handwriting words, that is what we find. So what that leads us to see, right, again, first objective was to answer the question, if trust is so central to all of our life and relationships, then why don't we see it within the New Testament writings? Well, the answer is that we do. That it's actually one of the most central themes in all of the New Testament writings. Because for the most part, every time you see faith, the word pistis is underneath it. And what that's telling us is that trust is a central theme, not only to our lives and relationships, but even to the New Testament writings, which in a way, I think, bolsters our ability to trust them because they accurately diagnose and define life as we know it. Okay, so with that, we can put the classroom away. And we'll come back and finish our conversation now, the second part of our objective for today, which is to talk about trust. Now that we see it's a central theme, how do we break it down and understand it more? And again, last week we talked about how when someone demonstrates the desire and the capacity to understand you, understanding being the first component, then that fosters, it fuels our ability to trust them. But that's far from the only thing that's necessary for trust. So in addition to that, we also see intent or motivation, that a person's why matters. Do they care about you or do they only care about themselves? So there's a couple of different ways we could have broken this down, right? Last week we looked at a bunch of different passages that showed how God sees us, how he hears us, he understands us, he knows us even better than we know ourselves. And his desire in the midst of that understanding is to connect with us. In some ways, we actually checked boxes 1 and 2 last week. So what I want to do this week, rather than looking at other passages that show the same thing, I want to look at a passage in which Jesus actually gets a little bit salty, that he says not to trust someone. He points to some of the most significant, most influential leaders in his day, and he says, you can't trust them. In their hearing, right in front of them, he says, don't trust them. And the reason why that he offers has everything to do with their motivation, with their intent. And so this is the passage, Luke chapter 21. I actually want to take it in two chunks. So Luke 21 reads like this. It says, as Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in 2 very small copper coins. And he says this about her. Truly, I tell you, he said. He's talking to a group of people. He's teaching in the temple courts in the city of Jerusalem. And he tells this to the people he's been talking to. He says, truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. Now, if we only had that passage, you might take it and interpret it, and some even have done this and have taken it and taught and said that Jesus is honoring this woman for her generosity because she gave all that she had to live on, and so you should do the same. You should give everything away. And yet, to do so is to completely miss his point. Because in fact, he's saying something entirely different in this passage. And we see that when we just take into consideration what comes directly before it. Because in the chapter leading up to this, all throughout chapter 20, Jesus is teaching in these temple courts and people are listening to him. And in the midst of it, these religious leaders, they walk up and they begin to ask him questions. And it's not because they're curious and they want to know what his answer is. The questions are designed specifically to trap him, to force him into giving an answer that would discredit him with the people that he's teaching, the people that he's leading. And yet, brilliantly, he turns the tables on them and answers in such a way that satisfies the question and actually puts them on the spotlight. And then afterwards, he continues to teach. And at the end of this chapter, just before this woman gives her two copper coins away, he says this. This is Luke chapter 20, verses 45 and 47. While all the people were listening, Jesus said to his disciples, beware of the teachers of the law. In other words, don't be relaxed in your trust with them. Don't be at ease. Don't be at peace in your ability to offer your trust to them. Don't be careless with them. Beware of them, because they like to walk around in flowing robes and love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely. He says this right before this woman walks up to the temple treasury, offers two copper coins, and he says that she gave all that she had to live on. He calls out these religious leaders specifically because they are placing a religious burden upon her back to give in such a way that she gives even what she has to live on. He says, you're devouring widows' households, and so you are not worth trusting. He's saying that you can't trust them because they care nothing for you. They love to be greeted with honor. They love to have flowing robes. They like to dress nice and drive something nice with the money that they have received, the money they've lined their pockets with off of your generosity by forcing it upon you. They love to do this, but they care nothing about you, and so they are not worth trusting. And I think the unfortunate thing about this is that it's not an isolated incident. But unfortunately, I would bet that there are many of us within this room who've actually experienced the same thing, either with an organization, perhaps a religious community, something that you gave so much of yourself to, so much of your life to, so much of your time and your energy and your attention and even your finances to, that you invested in it in so many ways because you were placing your trust in it only to find that in the end, it never really cared about you. And an experience like that often leaves us burned, where on the other side, it's not easy to trust again. And I think the unfortunate thing is that that has the really the tendency to not only impact our ability to trust a church or a community of faith, but even the ability to trust God, that relationship can get messed up as well, that it becomes collateral damage in the midst of this process. And so I think with that in mind, it's worth walking through this particular theme of intent and motivation, that it's worth taking it into consideration whether or not we offer someone or something our trust. But what I want to do now is take this theme and just walk through our three different categories together as we kind of come close to the end here. So with God, with others, and with church. So with God, I think one of the things that can help us, and this can get confusing on the other side of being burned, there's so much to sift through and to sort through, and I think one of the things that can be so helpful in the midst of the unsteadiness is to remind ourselves of who God is, who God has described himself to be, what God's character is. And one of the things we know from the biblical writings is that love is the motivation behind all of God's intentions. For example, when God spoke all things into existence. Light, love was the motivation. When God crafted the first human and breathed life into his lungs, giving us life, love was the motivation. When God commanded us to live within the boundaries of our design, not to take something from us, but to give something to us, love was the motivation. And when God extended mercy and compassion, even on the other side of our rebellion and our rejection of him, love was the motivation. And when Jesus stepped into time, bonding our humanity to his own divine nature so that he could pay the price for our redemption with his life, you can be sure that love was the motivation. Because God is love. And one of the things we find is that love is never careless. Carelessness loses trust because it shows that a person is only for themselves, that they're not for you or about you, and yet love always cares. And because God is love, one of the things we can know, that you can know, is that God's concern for you surpasses even that of yours for yourself. And so one of the things we know is that God's love is motivation. And one of the clearest places we see this expressed is in John 3:16, where it says, "For God so loved the world," that love was the motivation, "as he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." And if I could, real quick, notice, whoever believes in him. If you were to do a word study on that, you'd find that it's actually the Greek word pisteuo, which is the verb form of the word pistis, right? Pistis is the noun, pisteuo is the verb, that it's the same word, the same concept. And so, once again, we see trust central. Whoever believes in him, whoever trusts that Jesus is who he said he is, that he did what he said he would do, that he lived, that he died, that he rose again, and then trusts in a sense that our lives are lived out in a sense that is in response to those truths. Okay, so with God, love is the motivation behind all of God's intentions, and when we've been burned, one of the most helpful things to do is to remind ourselves of who God is. With others, people who demonstrate your value to them by factoring you into their decisions demonstrate a key component of trustworthiness. And this matters depending on the proximity, the degree of proximity a person has to you. So for example, when it comes to my barista, I don't need them to factor me into every decision they make. What car they buy, where they live, I don't care. I don't really need to know. But when I'm ordering my coffee, I want them to factor my desire into what they make for me. So if I order an Americano with cream, I don't want a cortado, right? But that's because there's not a high degree of proximity. But the higher the degree of proximity a person has, the more significance this takes on. So for example, marriage is one. Another one would be a business partner that you enter into a business relationship with. If you enter into a relationship with someone like that, that you can't trust to factor your well-being into their decisions, that you can't trust how they use their time, you can't trust how they use the finances, that you can't trust the way that they go about their lives, the decisions that they make, if you can't trust them to factor your well-being into their decisions, that puts you in an incredibly difficult position. And that's not to say that if you're in that state that all hope is lost, but it's more so just, it's wisdom to take that into consideration on the front side of a relationship, to know that this matters, and that if someone doesn't do this, perhaps they're not worthy of trust in this way. And yet if they do, it's a sign that this person is trustworthy. Okay, so that's with others. And then the last one would be with church. Spiritual community that creates a culture of safe and patient belonging demonstrates a key component of trustworthiness. Some of us, we belong to church community, faith communities, where you had to subscribe to a certain set of beliefs in order to belong. You had to sign on the dotted line to belong. You had to check certain boxes and perform in certain ways to belong. And if you didn't, then your experience within that entire community shifted drastically. And it was anything but pleasant. And we recognize that one of the most significant things that you can offer us here is your trust. That for you to make the decision to trust us is not a small thing, not a light thing, not an easy thing. And so we recognize that. And one of the ways that we work to earn your trust and to maintain your trust is by this, by creating a culture of safe and patient belonging, where you can belong before you believe. And if you have doubts about these things, you know, we can work through those things. It doesn't have to be something that causes a panic. We can chat about it. You don't have to be afraid of what's going to happen. Everyone has doubts at a certain point, and doubt can actually be something that leads us to truth. And so let's talk about it. If you have questions, we believe that questions deserve answers. If you don't subscribe to all of the beliefs that we have, that's fine. You can still belong and participate and be a full part of this community, because you can belong before you believe, and there is no expiration date on that. And that's one of the ways that we work to show that our motivation is for you, to create a culture where perhaps on the other side of being burned, you can begin to rebuild trust, not just with an organization, not just with others, but ultimately with God, so that we can have the chance even to celebrate that with you, just like we did earlier with the baptisms. But I think at the end of the day, the bottom line is that trust builders are for others, not just themselves. And over the course of time, people have a way of showing you, organizations have a way of showing you what they are for. And our hope is that one of the things that would be demonstrated so clearly here is that we are for you, not just so that your trust can be fostered with us, but ultimately so that you can know the joy and the peace that comes with being in the trusting relationship that Jesus invites us into, so that you can be at peace, be at ease, and be relaxed with God. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you for the time together this morning. Thank you for the chance to break down this concept of trust that is so central to not just our lives and our relationships, but even the way that the biblical writings describe what life and relationships are like for us. And we thank you that you haven't left us in the dark, confused, wondering what your intent is, what your motivation is with us, but you have shown us that love is the motivation behind everything that you do, behind every action that you have taken towards us, so that we might know your heart, know what your posture is towards us, so that we could place trust in you and know the peace and the joy that comes with that. And so would you help us to know you more so that we might know the peace that you offer in increasing measure across this life. In your name, amen.
Thank you again for listening to today's message. If you enjoyed this hopeful and helpful content, we'd love for you to subscribe and share an episode with a friend. Also, if you can please do us a huge favor and leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on, we'd really appreciate it. We'll see you again next week.